A very good morning to everyone. Our first case on this morning's call is number 06-3684, Cheryl Hall against the Nalco Company. Mr. Hollander.
May it please the court, counsel. In this case, the district court, without reaching the facts, erred by concluding that Cheryl Hall was not a member of the protected class under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. As no circuit court in the United States has reached this issue in the context of a Title VII employment case, this court has an historic opportunity this morning and today to find that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, or the PDA, covers infertility on a woman who seeks infertility treatment. A reversal of the district court's opinion by this court will give scores of women protection against unlawful discrimination.
Mr. Hollander, is it your position that any infertility treatment for a woman is covered by the PDA, even if it's not something like in vitro fertilization that might lead directly to pregnancy?
I think any woman who is seeking to become pregnant through an IVF or other artificial means is covered by the PDA. That's what the statute provides for.
But so any infertility problem?
Well, any infertility where the woman is seeking to become pregnant. We're not taking the position necessarily that a woman who's simply infertile is covered by the PDA, but rather an infertile woman who then seeks means to become pregnant is covered by the PDA. And in this case of Barr, though Ms. Hall was not pregnant, she was infertile, she was again seeking to become pregnant by undergoing such infertility treatment. It is well settled under the PDA that the statute covers not only pregnancy, but potential pregnancy. Now, the very language of the statute is clear that it covers pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. And that term related is very significant because the language of the statute is broad and is expansive. Further, if the statute wasn't clear enough on its face, the legislative history makes it clear that the PDA should be given a liberal construction. In 1978, when Congress was discussing the bill and ultimately passed, they said, in using the broad phrase, quote, woman affected by pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions, the bill makes clear that its protection extends to the whole range of matters concerning the childbearing process. In that legislative history, Representative Saracen noted that women have a right to protection before they become pregnant, and that again is key. In discussing the bill, Congress noted that the PDA was designed to protect women before, during, and after pregnancy. Now, more than a decade ago, one of our district courts issued its opinion in Picard versus Inland Steel. Though it was a district court opinion, as a landmark decision in this case. Now, in Picard, the district court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss and rejected the defendant's arguments that a woman's inability to become pregnant was not a covered condition under the PDA, and that infertility was a gender-neutral condition. The court noted that the language of the PDA was expansive, and in discussing the use of the word related, reasoned that it is a generous choice of wording, suggesting that interpretation should favor inclusion rather than exclusion in the close cases. Then after Pecoric, a year later, we had the case of Cleese versus Hewlett-Packard in 1995, District Court of Oregon. Consistent with Pecoric, the court held the PDA should apply to women who are trying to become pregnant, again, potential pregnancy.
Now, how does the word related in the statute play with or bear on the fact that both men and women can experience and seek treatment for infertility?
Well, again, the purpose of the statute, the language is to make it broad, but it applies to women who are trying to become pregnant because the whole underlying theme here, and counsel will argue, that men can become infertile too, they can seek treatment. But the whole goal here is to get the woman pregnant. And clearly the disparate impact is much heavier on a woman. It's historically been viewed.
But if the goal is to get a woman pregnant.
Correct.
Then why wouldn't fertility treatments for men bear on that?
Well, again, I think historically, based upon the discussion in passing the bill, they view this as a woman's problem. Well, again, they will take the position that the statistics show that equally men and women can become infertile in the same proportion or percentages. It's the woman that has to go the greater procedures, has to have to go on bed rest, time off of work. And again, the goal is the same, whether it's a man or a woman, the goal is to get the woman pregnant. Therefore, the PDA would cover a woman who is trying to get pregnant. Oh, okay. Thank you, Judge. Okay. I don't know if you had a follow-up question. I was waiting, but it didn't come. The Cleese Court and others since have made it crystal clear that it is illegal to discriminate against women on the basis of pregnancy, regardless of whether the woman is actually pregnant. Now, in this case, the district court erroneously relied upon two other authorities, two circuit court opinions, the Sachs versus Franklin Covey case and the Crowell versus Iowa Methodist case, in reaching its opinion. In Sachs, again, both of these are insurance disputes. They're not an employment case under Title VII.
Why does that make a difference?
Well, ultimately, it may not make a difference, but no court has decided this in a Title VII case. However, the Sachs case, very interesting, though it was an ERISA case deciding whether the issue of infertility treatments were covered, in footnote 4 of the Sachs case, the court expressly stated that they declined to state whether an infertile woman who took time off to undergo an infertility treatment stated a claim or a cause of action. So they would not reach that question in the Sachs case. So in the Sachs case, again, the court did not consider the purpose of fertility treatments was to become pregnant. The Crowell case held that infertility outside of the PDA's protection, as it strictly did not fall within the language of pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical condition. Again, the court in that case ignored the fact that women who undergo fertility treatments are trying to become pregnant. And Crowell, again, is distinguishable from the case of Barr, as defendant in that case maintained a policy of exclusion in its insurance policy for certain fertility treatments. Here, we have no such policy. With that, I'm going to defer to my counsel and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollander. We'll hear now from Mr. Lees.
May it please the court, Mark Lees, counsel. Your Honor, this is a very simple case. It started out with a charge, as the court is well aware. Sorry, was there a question, Your Honor?
No, it's just that I don't think it's simple.
The charge was simple when we started out. The case started out as a simple charge that I did not receive fertility treatments, and that is a protected medical condition under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. That's what went before Judge Kaur. That's what Judge Kaur considered. And since the case has now gone to the and when Judge Kaur decided the case, he had the benefit of cases that Judge Alesia did not have in the Pechorek case, the Sachs case and the Crowell case, Second and Eighth Circuits, which have further looked into the history of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and all followed the same statutory construction that Judge Kaur did, namely, are infertility treatments named in the statute? And we have pregnancy, which is not infertility. We have childbirth, which is not infertility, and related conditions. And looked at it with a common sense point of view. Related conditions relates to you are pregnant, you are having childbirth. Those are the related conditions.
Doesn't the language of Johnson Control suggest that the protections of the PDA extend beyond women who are actually pregnant to include women who might become pregnant?
I'm glad you asked that question, Your Honor, because in that particular case, the court dealt with a specific policy that said that women who are fertile cannot work in our lead battery operation because of the potential of fetal damage. The court specifically said, I believe at pages 197 and 198, but I could be off, that this case is not about fertility alone. And the court then talked about the fact that this policy was so blatantly sexist, and had the case dealt with male infertility, because men could suffer potential defects by being exposed to lead, which would hurt their children, had the policy dealt with male infertility as opposed to just female fertility, the case might have come out differently, but that policy spoke only to the issue of fertile women. It had nothing to do with men, and as we believe in this case, fertility is gender neutral. It is general neutral, and the statistics that counsel put in on appeal indicate that 35% of women and 35% of men are typically fertile, infertile.
Counsel, the procedure in question in this case is not gender neutral. And what we're talking about is the surgical implantation phase of in vitro fertilization, which can only happen to women.
That is true, Your Honor.
That be the focus? I mean, you started out your argument saying that we're talking about infertility treatment generically, but everyone knew in this case, and it's undisputed, that the particular procedure in question here is the surgical implantation phase of IVF, which only affects women.
And I don't disagree with you at all, Your Honor. I was trying to respond to the judge's question about
Well, why shouldn't that be our focus here?
Okay, then let's focus. Let's go back to the decision. Judge Kaur said that, as I indicated earlier, infertility is not mentioned in the language of the statute itself.
But you're not addressing my question.
Okay.
This is de novo review.
All right, okay. As far as the issue of the in vitro fertilization is concerned, yes, it is the procedure that was involved here, and yes, the intent was to become pregnant. That's the allegation in the complaint. There are similar type of fertility treatments that men can undergo.
Look, if a woman is undergoing something like the implantation of a fertilized egg, if that's successful, that's going to directly result in a pregnancy. So why couldn't that be considered treatment for a pregnancy-related condition?
Well, Your Honor, that's what this case is in front of this court today to decide. The cases, the Sachs and Kruhl case, it's in the context of insurance, but it's insurance to cover in vitro fertilization so that someone can become pregnant, and the court said that we're not insuring that particular condition or that particular treatment for infertility is not a violation of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, even though in vitro fertilization ultimately may result in the pregnancy of the woman.
I think more importantly may result. It seems to me that regardless of whether the conditions and treatments are comparable, as between the two sexes, the reality is that only women can actually become pregnant.
I don't dispute that, Your Honor.
If you don't dispute that,
I don't dispute that only
then,
women
then,
can.
Then to say that a woman's fertility status is unrelated to pregnancy seems to me to deny the obvious.
Well, if the court believes that, the court can reach that result. The plain language of the standard, which is what Judge Kaur looked at, was it is not included there. There are seven other cases subsequent to that that have reached the same conclusion, including two courts of appeals cases. The legislative history does not specifically mention infertility, and infertility is not a unique condition to women. It's a condition shared by both. So this is really not a sex-based classification. It is gender neutral. And I respect what Your Honor
said. Right. Before this adverse employment action occurred, the plaintiff had announced to her boss that she was trying to become pregnant, expected to be pregnant. Could that be the basis of a cause of action under Title VII if an adverse employment action ensued?
Potentially, depending on what the particular facts of the circumstances at that particular point in time in terms of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, we do not believe that it would be a violation of Title VII under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which specifically focused on overturning the Supreme Court decision in Gilbert, which denied women pregnancy benefits. Gilbert versus General Electric, it denied pregnancy benefits to women. So the Congress wanted to say, let's give pregnancy benefits to women who are pregnant or who are undergoing childbirth. We are now moving one stage from that to say, if this decision comes out, that we are now going to cover the process of getting pregnant as in addition to the actual state of being pregnant and childbirth.
Is there anything in the legislative history that indicates that was the sole intent of Congress to overrule Gilbert?
There is a lot of discussion about the Gilbert decision and the fact that the Congress felt that it was unfair to women, what happened there. The court carved out pregnancy as not being a category that was entitled to protection in that particular case. It was not sex discrimination in that case. Yes, Your Honor.
See, to me, your argument is a bit redolent of General Electric versus Gilbert, because, of course, the Supreme Court said that denying pregnancy benefits wasn't discrimination against women, but rather discrimination against pregnant persons versus non-pregnant persons. And it seems to me, as I think it seems to you, that it was precisely to overrule that sort of, well, nonsense that the Congress enacted the PDA.
Well, I respect Your Honor's observations on that, but we believe that the proper focus, again, is we're talking about a condition, infertility. That was what was alleged in the charge. That's what Judge Kaur dealt with, infertility. Infertility, he believed, was not covered. There's case law to support that. So the process of or being terminated because of infertility is not a violation of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, again, relying on Sachs, relying on the Crowell case for that. And if we focus back on infertility, which is a shared trait of men and women, then we do not have that particular issue. I would like to address one other thing, Your Honor. I hit that turn off. Is the issue of impact. That was not developed at the lower court. It was not until we got to the appeal that there was this issue of the disparate impact or alleged impact of infertility on men versus women. And there's a lot of material in the appellant's brief that speaks to the alleged burdensomeness of certain treatments to women versus certain treatments to men. That was never fully developed. There is no findings whatsoever concerning that as a basis for a decision that were we to allow in vitro fertilization to be covered, that somehow would be because in vitro fertilization is more burdensome upon women than a similar procedure that would be on an infertile man. That record is not developed here. We have a very narrow decision of statutory interpretation of the language, the legislative history, and the case law and what the plaintiff claimed in this case. The case was not about potential pregnancy. It was about infertility. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lees. How much time does Mr. Hollander have? Thank you.
Again, may it please the court, just to respond to a question the court raised, under the scenario that the court gave, if a woman announced that she was pregnant and an employer terminated her on that basis, she clearly would have a cause of action because, again, the statute, the legislative history, and the case law all recognize potential pregnancy. So she would clearly have a cause of action. Counsel also raised an issue about when Congress passed this act in 1978, Congress was silent on the issue of infertility. Well, the IVF procedure didn't exist in 1978, so of course they were silent on the issue. And it's for the courts to determine and interpret the statute in this case. In terms of gender neutrality, infertility is not gender neutral. Again, it is historically generally considered to be a woman's problem. There are significant and much more invasive procedures when dealing with a woman compared to a man when we're talking about fertility. In the incident case, an IVF, there are a number of stages. During the ovulation induction stage, a woman must take fertility drugs, which may have a serious side effect. During the egg retrieval stage, a woman must go invasive surgery to remove the eggs from the ovarian follicle. During the transfer, the embryo resulting from insemination is transferred to the woman's uterine cavity or fallopian tubes. In the incident case, Ms. Hall had to undergo surgery. She had bed rest, weeks off of work in this case, before she could return. Clearly, the disparate impact falls upon the woman. And again, we can't ignore the fact the whole goal here is to get the woman pregnant. Unless the panel has any additional questions for me, we respectfully request this court reverse and remand this case for further proceedings with the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Hollander. Indeed, the court thanks both counsel for their fine arguments today.